feels about Baradai and that kind of a coalition that you suggest.
Well, they're jealous of their power. And again, they are the power right now. I mean, so this essentially, that guy wants to take our control of the country from us. So, you know, they presumably would resist that.
What about
unless they realize that the they don't have a choice because there's still hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. I know that I was interviewed by NPR today about the idea of the whole thing around this general, that general, and how they'll deal with it, and going to shoot Baradai and whatever. And you know, I gave my best assessment that I knew, but I tried to underscore was they're not the ones. Ultimately, the power is coming from the street, and the choices that the people on the street will give them. No, I satisfy some, but the vast majority, I think, no way. I mean, they want democracy.
What I'm concerned that people will eventually get tired and want life to go back to normal.
Yeah.
Go home, and then the police will move in and go after people, and the United States won't care because there won't be anybody in the street.
Right.
I'm wondering.
That is a risk to be sure, but at the same time. As we've seen in a number of cases, if you that nonviolent struggle, arms like guerrilla warfare, like electoral campaigns or whatever. I mean, but yeah, you have to think strategically. You got to think, where are your strengths and weaknesses? Where's the opponent's strengths and weaknesses? And in a nonviolent struggle like guerrilla warfare, you know there are times you may need to make a tactical retreat. You may need to diversify your tactics. That is, more general strikes, targeted boycotts, smaller actions, factory takeovers, the kind of thing to disrupt things in ways that might be more difficult for large scale repression. Keep things alive, expose the nature of the new regime, and then come back. In a couple of weeks or whatever, and then try again with a more massive kind of contestation of public space and moving on the palace and that kind of thing.
Maybe the U.S. would care if things died down a little bit, and then there was this more undercover reign of terror.
Well, that's where we come in. That's where we come in.
Well,
I think they care again if the resistance was continuing. I think they care about America's image in the Arab world, given this trend that we're seeing. And let me just mention, this is something I should have emphasized in the main part of my talk, that this is spreading. And again, especially given the centrality of Egypt in the Arab world. We've already seen protests in Yemen, in Jordan, Algeria, in Libya, in Morocco, in Sudan, and there's one planned in a couple of days in Syria. I mean, this is... 2011 may be the Middle East, but 1989 was Eastern Europe. And again, and though I've been disappointed in Obama in innumerable ways, I really don't think he wants us to be on the wrong side of history. So again, if the movement keeps movements alive, and there's solidarity here, again, this is another place where we come in. I really think that the momentum will continue, and it'll be hard to get away. With that kind of large scale repression, because people are paying attention to Egypt now. They weren't paying much attention to. I mean, how many people were closely following events in Egypt before a couple weeks ago? this is. I think it's not only aroused the Egyptian people, but I think it's also aroused international interest and solidarity to Egypt. Yeah.
I got my complete recent education. Article about the presidential elections. If you guys haven't read this yet, it's very interesting and comprehensive. And I thought the timing was really interesting that you wrote it and then like 2 weeks later this happened.
Mm.
So my question is, you saw this coming. You probably weren't the only one who saw it coming. But the State Department didn't put out any kind of warnings for tourists. I'm wondering why you think that might have happened.
Again, they're oblivious. They And by the way, let me say this about the WikiLeaks thing, is that, I mean, yeah, it's really cool all this stuff is getting out, but, you know, I did my dissertation looking at diplomatic cables, the very kind of things that WikiLeaks released, only they were declassified because they were like 30 years ago. It was like the 1950s and yeah, the CIA intervention in Guatemala and Iran and stuff like that. And it's amazing to read those things. You know, it wasn't United Fruit. It wasn't the oil companies. Those idiots really did think the commies were taking over. I mean, you know, it was ridiculous. It wasn't true, but that's how they saw things. And one of the WikiLeaks releases was from the ambassador to Morocco that thought about, oh, the Western Saharans are happy under Moroccan occupation, and Moroccans have liberalized things so much. You know, they don't have the shanty towns. He's never been there. I've been there. It's the worst police state I've ever seen. They're desperate for their freedom. You know. But you know, this is an occupied territory Morocco, you know, seized in 1975. It's actually the subject of my most recent book. But they, you know, so don't take so again, you know, take a lot of the WikiLeaks stuff with a grain of salt, because again, these guys are cloistered in their embassy, and they have their own favorite contacts, usually people friendly with the regime, if it's a friendly regime, and again, a lot of these diplomats are not bad people. They really are. You know, they want to serve their country, and they are. Yeah, and I've been to about a dozen foreign embassies, and usually a couple staffers will slip me something that's not official and let me know what's really going on. But most of them are pretty oblivious.
I know.
It really is. I think one thing. I mean, that's why I think a lot of people in the Middle East and a lot of leftists have these conspiracy theories. Because, and then the more I look at study U.S. foreign policy, I've been doing it for more years. The more and more, I'm concluded these guys don't know what the hell they're doing. You know, they're idiots. I mean, it's just staggering. Or not idiots as much as that they have these ideological blinders that you know, it's almost Kuhnian. They're in their own little paradigm, and they don't know what's going on. Yeah, in the back.
Specifically, I'm wondering how important Suez is nowadays, and more generally, how important international trade and multinationals are, and what their influence is in the situation.
I mean, there are some key corporations that benefit from their ties to the specific regime and the special deals they get. But I think international capital as a whole, which, you know, it probably isn't too concerned. Specifically on the Suez Canal, you know, it's still flowing. The tugboat operators haven't doing the general strike. You know, things are normal. And in terms of oil prices, you know, Egypt doesn't produce hardly any oil at all, and most of our oil comes on super tankers that are too big to go through the canal anyway. I mean, prices have gone up a little bit just because of, you know, speculation whenever there's, you know, a crisis of one kind or another. But you know, so there are going to be specific corporate interests that may be hit. But I don't think it's going to be a huge issue, because, you know, and this is what's interesting, especially for those who are freaking out about the Muslim Brotherhood taking over, or, you know, or the fact that Egypt won't be as friendly. Even from an enlightened U.S. self-interest perspective, even if you're assuming the U.S. is going to remain the big superpower and we're going to remain the kind of global economy, even if you're coming from that perspective, in certain ways, what's happening in Egypt and elsewhere, in the short to medium term, will make things a little more complicated, because it's messy dealing with democracies instead of one or two elites that you have in your pocket and that kind of thing. It's a drag. But you know, when people have the freedom to work, you know, on their issues, their concerns, their grievances, peacefully through an established democratic process, they're much less prone to be attracted to extremist ideologies. They're much less likely to support these Islamic extremists and support terrorism and that kind of thing. You know, so you know, a democratic Middle East in the long term is much more stable than a Middle East with these dictators propped up by the United States against the will of the majority of their population. So I think more enlightened capitalists would actually we're actually feeling pretty good right now because stability in the long term is actually good for business. Yeah.
What do the Saudis, either the royal family or the Saudi public, think of all this?
Well, they're not hearing much about it. and the Saudis, of course, are supporting the Egyptian government, as are the Israelis, and as are a number of other despots. So if I was a Middle Eastern despot, whether I was pro or anti-American, I'd be a little nervous right now. I think the House of Saud is safe, for at least for the time being. I think, and for various reasons, they're a little more solid. But Sudan, Jordan, Morocco, Yemen, things get a little dicey there. Yeah.
One of Barack Obama's first public pieces of advice to Mubarak, before it became clear that he was truly in danger, was to establish a dialogue, a genuine dialogue between government and the people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what you, how you evaluate the quality or even the existence of a dialogue in this country between its government and its people. And what that means for the future of democracy.
I think for real dialogue, I think really basically people need to demand it. I mean, there's a famous story. It's now pretty well known, but I think it's important. I don't think we take it as seriously as we should. Obama was at a fundraiser in January of 2008 in the presidential campaign. It was in New Jersey at some wealthy person's house, and you had to give a bunch of money to get in. So, there were 50 or 100 people there. So small enough group to actually be able to talk to this candidate one-on-one. And someone asked, what about Israel-Palestine? I mean, here's a guy who's friends with Rashid Khalidi. He grew in the African-American, came of age in the African-American student movement in the 80s. He knows what's really going on. He's the first president to actually know the Palestinian narrative and know what needs to happen there. So they're saying, will you be willing to press Israel to make the necessary compromises for peace, is basically what the question was. And interesting way he answered it. He didn't directly answer the question. He told the story of Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Workers, the largest black union at the time. This is when rail transportation was the number one means of transportation. And he talked about how Randolph met the newly elected President Roosevelt and talked about, hey, we need to be able to organize, and as interstate transportation, we need a federal law to protect us. So the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters could actually be a recognized union. And he explained it, and Roosevelt listened and said, okay, you convinced me. Now I've got a constituency who will make me do it. Make me do it. That's how Obama answered the question. Indeed, I should mention that within 6 months of that talk, FDR signed in the National Railway Labor Relations Act, 1933.
But now
he's quit bugging. But again, I think we really need to emphasize this thing to make him do it. By the way, before I forget, I have an email list. Some of you are already on it, where I send my articles out. Come out every couple of weeks. Probably more frequently now. All things in Egypt. And if you can, someone start a piece of paper around on a pad. And again, as you know, when you're writing email addresses, be real clear what the letters are. Take the time to write it. Yes.
Talk a little bit more about Jordan.
Okay. Jordan is an absolute monarchy, which does allow for some parliamentary, does allow some competing parties, debates in Congress. The press is relatively open. You can discuss a lot of things except the absolute monarchy. The king can dismiss parliament. He's the one who appoints the prime minister in the government, etc. And over the years, both King Abdullah and his father, King Hussein, they would open things up for a while. Things were going easy. If things got a little sketchy, they clamped down pretty hard. And they had a series of major protests in Jordan the past couple of weeks, and the king ended up firing the entire government and bringing in some new people. But but people are starting to say you know, let's have more of a real you know, constitutional monarchy, you know, where we can elect the prime minister and have more of a say. So I don't think it'll be an effort to overthrow the government, you know, like the Palestinians and certain leftist Jordanians tried to do in the, you know, back in 1970-71, but by force of arms. But I do think there, you know, we are going to see pressures for more of a constitutional monarchy. There's actually some precedent to that in Kuwait. Just a few years ago, they had what they call the Orange Revolution, where people in the opposition, with a lot of women in leadership, incidentally, challenged the way the parliament had been gerrymandered so that these very conservative, traditional tribal groups in rural areas had much more representation than Kuwaitis in the cities and that kind of thing. And they wanted more fair representation, more power to parliament, and they succeeded. Kuwait is and now, you know, one of the most open, you know, politically, of the Emirates. Yes.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about where this whole revolution came from. You mentioned that you had been there a few years ago and trained some people, and I wasn't sure if those people played a role.
It wasn't quite a training per se. I've done nonviolence training. This is more of kind of a theory, dynamics, history kind of thing, because we don't like to give advice to folks just to say they know the situation, that kind of thing.
You didn't actually start it yourself.
Right. But I mean, interesting, you sometimes get these conspiracy theories, you know, that, somebody did a workshop and did that, but therefore, and it's really bizarre, because I worked with some of these people, like from Canada. I mean, I guess from the far left as much as I do from the right, interesting,
wow.
Because, you know, they'll say, well, this NGO that I worked with, you know, has a guy who was on a board with a guy who was, connected with the former head of the CIA, or this guy that, Peter Ackerman's Family Foundation funds this organization, and Peter Ackerman's at Freedom House, and Freedom House, you know, gets congressional funding, and, you know, therefore we're doing all this kind of. I mean, you wouldn't. I mean, I know those of you who know me, you think it's pretty bizarre that I'm this imperialist, regime change, CIA connected guy. But you actually see this on the web sometime. You know, Google my name sometime, you'll be surprised at some of the conspiracy theories I'm supposedly involved in. And it doesn't help that these workshops, in part because I've also worked with Zimbabweans and Iranians and Burmese, and so we're part of the U.S. conspiracy as well. But I've mostly worked with Palestinians and Western Saharans and Hondurans and et cetera, et cetera. So, but that's because you're wanting to influence these movements and make them more, susceptible to American capital if they come to power. But whatever. So anyway, to get back to the question, you know, these workshops, I got to know some of these folks and saw, you know, again, I thought sooner or later things were coming. If you want to look for a spark, there are a couple things. You know, one, obviously the global recession was making a really bad economic situation, even worse. There was a murder a few months ago of a very popular blogger, and he was in an internet cafe, and the police came in and dragged him out and beat him to death right out in front of people. I mean, it was not subtle. Yeah, really, then the election and the parliamentary elections in late November were even more fraudulent than usual. I mean, in terms of ballot stuffing and stealing ballots and you know, beating up people and all these kinds of things. And then, but I think in many ways Tunisia was really what got people to think, whoa, you know, we really can do it here. And I think in many ways that really was the spark. Yes.
I have two questions. Egypt is an Arabic country. Why have they closed off their border to the Gaza Strip?
Because the U.S. put the squeeze on in terms of the aid and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. This is very much U.S. pressure.
And the second question is, what's the significance of Egypt that makes it number two in foreign military aid?
Again, it's by far the largest Arab country geographically. I mean, it's where Asia and Africa come together, so it's canal, you know, that kind of thing. It was in many ways a way of buying the, initially, you know, some logic to it, sort of kind of buying their loyalty since they'd been allied to the Soviet Union for, you know, quite a few years before then. But then again, it became, you know, largely a way of subsidizing agribusiness and the arms industry, and, you know, kind of took on a minimum of its own. So who hasn't asked a question yet? They close the railways and people are marching. They're marching to Cairo.
My feeling is that last night was sort of the last opportunity for Tiananmen / Iranian, you know, crushing. And now people are spinning out a scenario that whatever, you know, replaces Mubarak or whatever comes is going to be going to put a lot more pressure on U.S. force us to sort of reset our relationship to Israel and maybe have some very positive. Can you see any scenario in which that doesn't happen? I'm sure that's what Israel and a lot of people in the United States are trying to figure out now. A methodology for repression that stops that.
I don't think, at this point, I don't think repression alone can do it. I mean, I think the more realistic worst case scenario is that less corrupt, less inept military leadership by, you know, bringing in a few token, you know, people, you know, from the more elite sectors of the opposition will, you know, lead enough people to think that they won. It's not worth struggling anymore. I think that, you know, that would be I think the more realistic scenario. And again. And also, you know, the worst case scenario we're hearing in the media is, oh, it's going to be another Iran, because look what happened in Iran. They had a broad-based pro-democracy movement against the U.S.-backed autocrat, and guess what? And look what happened. But, you know, just one minute, and this is a little off-topic, but because you hear this a lot, I want just to kind of to give the rebuttal to that, because I think it's important. You know, one is the difference between Sunni and Shia Islam. Islam is a clear hierarchy with the Ayatollahs and the like, so they already had a built-in organization much stronger than any of the even more reactionary clerics in Egypt have. And the Shah was even more repressive than Mubarak in terms of eliminating the leftist, liberal, you know, moderate, secular opposition. And so the mosque was the one place they still had the organization, so they could take advantage of that power vacuum to take over. Also, the merchant class, what they call the Bazaaris, you know, they were very tied into the networks of the Ayatollahs, whereas the Bazaaris, the merchant class in Egypt, they're dependent on tourist dollars. They don't want to alienate, you know, they don't want to go kind of in a direction there. The big thing is that civil society is far more stronger in Egypt today than it was in Iran in 1979, and finally, in many respects, the in many ways the there was a much more religious overtone of the movement itself on the ground even from the beginning, in part as a reaction to the forced secularization of the Shah, and even more overt influence of the United States and that kind of thing. And it was almost trendy for young Iranians at that time to be religious, you know, whereas we're seeing, again, much more stronger secular orientation. By secular, I don't mean that, you know, they're atheists or agnostics. I assume the vast majority of the young protesters are observant Muslims, as well as a fair number of observant Christians. There's a large Christian minority in that country. But that they don't believe in a theocracy. They don't believe in kind of the traditional kind of Islamist kind of rule. Yes.
Steve, could you say something about how you could see possible spillover of the Egypt in this thing in the Palestinian territory, West Bank, vis-a-vis Fatah, PA,
Well, I mean, there's certainly plenty of Palestinians in the West Bank who are rather disgusted at Fatah, and there are Palestinians in Gaza are distrusted of Hamas, I mean, especially the way they broke the back of the teachers' union and did other nasty things. Abbas, on one hand, is and his prime minister have cleaned up a lot of the corruption and excesses he found under Arafat. But at the same time, he doesn't have that aura, you know, that Arafat had as a founder of the movement. So I think you will see a greater pressure for democratization, including perhaps a massive protest. But you know, it's also just important there's some very legitimate complaints about both Hamas and the Gaza Strip and Fatah in the West Bank. The number one issue, of course, is the occupation. And so this may embolden resistance against the wall, resistance against the settlement, and the already burgeoning nonviolent resistance movement against the occupation. Yes?
Could you say something about the economic outlook of Egypt, particularly with the view of the young population?
Well, it's bad, and I would hate to see a democratic government, you know, hit by this phenomenon of rising expectations that they're not able to fulfill, because so many of the issues have to do with globalization and neoliberalism and the whole, and also the fact that their population is growing, you know, at least as fast as the economy. And this has been the population growth alone is something that's difficult. Also, the fact that ecologically, Egypt is a it's not sustainable. 95% of the population live on the 5% of the land that's arable. And the Aswan Dam, which is supposed to do all these great miracles, it's by preventing the Nile flooding, you know, you are preventing new nutrients coming to the soil. There's the salt water encroachment, you know, coming in the delta. And, you know, the silt is backing up on the dam so fast that pretty soon the turbines are going to stop working. And just on an environmental level, Egypt's in big trouble. I mean, so they got huge, huge problems, and that's one thing I try to reassure a lot of the strongly pro-Israel crowd. You know, that said, you know, look, these guys have so many problems. The last thing they do is want to get in a war with Israel, especially since you know, Israel kicked their butt 4 times in a row, and when they did fight Israel, and Israel's advantage is even greater now. There are all these really serious problems, but you know, again, I am. I'm not one of those who thinks liberal democracy is a be-all and end-all in terms of justice or anything, but at least with liberal democracy, the workers and women and environmentalists and the poor and others are able to organize and mobilize and petition for their grievances, and you know the government can at least do some things to ease the burden and ease the pain. But you know, a dictatorship is is not responsive, and when you have, in many ways, economic liberalization without political liberalization is like the worst combination that you can think of. But that's both what Tunisia and Egypt are going through, and I think they are what, in many ways, were responsible, you know, for the uprising. So, but you know, a democratic government might be more sensitive to sustainable bottom-up economic development. Might be more sensitive to the environmental concerns, might be more willing to promote family planning. You know, might be willing to, you know, a lot. They you know, might do more to advance women's rights and other things. So I think we can. I think there'll be. I'm hopeful that that there are again serious problems. That at least having a more accountable government will give at least some hope for a better future.
So. What's behind Hamas banning support demonstrations, that they're afraid that they'll turn against them, and also what's behind this recent Israeli, maybe the last day or so, Israeli statement that now they were going to build up their army? Are they just looking for more arms?
The Israeli military-industrial complex is, proportionally speaking, at least as influential as ours. All that talk's so pretty silly in terms of Israel. In terms of Hamas, I don't demonize Hamas like some people do. They are an authoritarian group. They did have some grassroots support because they are seen as cleaner and less corrupt than Fatah. which they definitely were. But since they've been in power for a while, they've shown themselves to be quite willing to be corrupt and authoritarian as well. And you know, there is growing dissatisfaction, with their rule. Of course, you know, the blockade and everything. You know, they've been able to blame everything on what Israel and the United States and others have done. But you know, a lot of people aren't very happy with what they're doing. And I think there's a generally free election throughout Palestine. I have no question that none of the above will win. If it's between Fatah and Hamas, people really are looking for a genuine alternative. Yes?
Yeah, just the fact on Hamas, when they got elected in 2006, did they renounce the position regarding Israel's existence? Did they turn around and say that they're willing to accept?
They're willing, they are willing to have a long-term ceasefire within the 67 borders. They have not, recognized Israel's right to exist, per se. And, I think it's just a show of pragmatism. And I should also mention in 2006, they won the majority of parliamentary seats in the Palestinian Authority, but they did not win the majority. They got maybe 44-46%, something like that. And part of it was because Fatah was so confident, they actually had some Fatah candidates running against each other and given districts, and it was first past the post. So the Hamas people ended up ended up winning.
So they're willing to have a long-term ceasefire,
At this stage, that is indeed their position.
Has that position been maintained?
As far as I know, they still are willing to have a long-term, we're talking decades, long ceasefire based on the 67 borders. And I think it's basically because they like the PLO did eventually, like most Arab governments eventually, have realized that for better or worse, Israel's there to stay. And you got to live with it, and you got to work from there, and do what you can, and maybe for demographic and trade and other reasons, it could evolve into a binational state, and eventually one state or whatever. But making war and trying to push Israel in the sea or destroy it or whatever, it's just not going to work, and it's totally unrealistic. It isolates you, gives Israel an excuse to go to war. So I think it's just, so even though they don't feel like they can stomach saying the words right to exist, because right to exist, in certain ways implies justifying what Israel did in 48 and subsequently, they're pragmatic enough to know that they can't destroy.
And of course, Israel is working on their right.
Oh yeah, of course. That's a key point right there. Any questions about Egypt or Tunisia or nonviolent action in the Arab world or? Anybody who's not asking it? Well, thank you very much for coming out. Please thank the Resource Center and the people who helped organize and make this possible. The RCMB, more than any other group I know, has combined interest in nonviolence, nonviolent action, and interest in the Middle East. And we're so fortunate to be in Santa Cruz, where such a group exists. And like a lot of groups who rely on contributions, they've been struggling a lot with the economic downturn in recent years. So please contribute to RCND and their really outstanding work for nonviolence and for peace and justice in the Middle East. And by the way, I have a website, www.stephenzunis.org. You can get my articles on Egypt and other things if you want.